Okay, hi. So we're gonna have a bit of a panel discussion to summarize all the conversations that have gone on this week. Particularly the breakout rooms have been separated, so people haven't been able to see all of them. So we're gonna start with a bit of a summary over those. And then we'll get into, as I mentioned in Slack, we'll talk about what we've all learned from each other this week and how we can move forward. Got Ilya and Ellie up here to help me out with this, and I can fire questions at them. And I think Marc Olivier is going to help as well. Wonderful. And Reina is going to be helping with all the online communication to make sure. So there'll be lots of opportunity for everyone to give their thoughts. Obviously, I'll be directing the questions, but I'd like to make sure that everyone has a chance to share their reflections as well. Okay. So I'll let you know when it's time to chime in. Wonderful. So let's get started. So we started out with talking about a lot about the open problems that we felt that could be aided from the communication between the two communities, as well as just maybe shared problems. So yeah, let's start with just sort of quick recaps of the discussions that were had in each of the room. I know it's going to be tough to keep it a little bit short. Do you want to start with the nomenclature?
Yeah, well, so it's possible that you were there, so you can keep me honest, right?
I was, but I'm moderator. It's your duty.
So one of the themes. So you know, I gave this intro thing on the first day, and I said, "Oh, well, statisticians use the word model in this way, and physicists don't." And then Stefan immediately said, "That's not even like a consensus in statistics. People use the word model differently in statistics." And that kind of was a theme that kept happening with the nomenclature effort, where, you know, we were sitting there and we were putting things on the board with a big dividing line on the quantum side and the statistics side and trying to draw parallels perhaps between concepts. And I think one of the things we kept coming back to is just the fact that in statistics there is a big diversity of nomenclature also. So one of the things I got, I mean, I'm very interested in this nomenclature project long term. Like after this ends, I'm planning to continue working on it. But I think it's like a bigger effort than just originally the thinking was, oh, we'll write like a devil's dictionary or something, right? But I don't think it's going to be like that. I think it's going to be like, I'm not even sure, like maybe a sequence of short essays discussing sort of the underlying ontology in both communities a little bit before like it even makes sense to talk about how things map back and forth. So that's one thing I got out of it. And of course, we have some notes from there. So, and I think, you know, we're planning to continue. And there were definitely fruitful connections that we discussed. There was a lot of discussion about faithfulness, for example, about exclusions and things like that. And individuals versus population level stuff as well. Anything you want to add to that, since you were there?
Okay. Actually, I think I'll just throw that to Stefan. If there's anything you wanted to add, as being the person there.
No, I think that the only thing it reflects also that certain problems are at the center focus of interest for the quantum community, but not necessarily at the... One of them is tradition, so you have sort of developed parallel thinkings, notions with the same word, but other ones reflect that actually it's sort of the focus of interest is slightly different. Although there are mathematical similarities and there are the point of view or the way you look at it is also different. And that's also reflected in things like, say, fine-tuning versus faithfulness, etc. They're related, but they're sort of slightly hitting different things. So it's quite complicated to describe this. The similarity and dissimilarity in the terminology, because it's deeper than just words.
Deeper than just words, I think, is probably the best way to summarize
it.
So with that, I'm going to throw up to Ellie to describe what happened in the post-selection room.
Well, we realized that there was a bunch of things that the statisticians knew that we didn't know. And it was really exciting to find what I found really surprising results. I think many of us had this intuition that it post-selection, assuming that we're not talking about nodes having children, which are the ones being co-selected upon, that would induce correlations in a strictly stronger sense than just sharing some hidden correlation. And we found that that's not the case. Like there's this undirected three-cycle, bidirected three-cycle, and it turns out each can do something that the other cannot. So it's it there's a lot of subtleties there. And then we found out that when we start thinking about the distributions which come under selection, there are these equality constraints, which are not conditional independence constraints, they're not Verma constraints, but they have a whole family. They're like interaction, like absence of interaction constraints.
Yeah.
But then, you know, Robin Evans pointed out that there are equality constraints in these post-selected DAGs, which aren't even of that flavor, which is a sort of a curveball. But then, you know, we had Murat here, who was familiar with MAGs, which was something that I had sort of seen the word in a couple of papers, but never really played with, pointed out that it was a efficient tool to understand whether or not two scenarios were actually equivalent under post-selection, up to conditional independence solutions. Like, they could be distinguished further not by MAGs, but if we just wanted to understand, like, are the conditional independence relations under post-selection distinguishing these things? Apparently it's a solved problem. And we were gonna sort of, you know, spin our wheels and spend a year trying to solve the same problem. And it's really nice to sort of say, well, here it is. It's just, we've done it already. It's exactly what we're looking for. So did we make deep progress in terms of new insights into this problem? Maybe not, but I think we all came away with an appreciation for things that we didn't know beforehand, which is a huge sort of shortcut leap forward.
Yeah, it sounds about leaps a huge efficient gain anyway, which is probably the best that can be hoped for out of any of this. Does anyone have anything they wanted to add from that room? Okay, so then we'll move on to quasi-probability. I think, Ilya, you were in that room?
Yeah, I think the problem statement was understanding. So there was a conjecture, which is that if I have a latent variable DAG, and we allow latent variable parts of the factorization to be weird and negative, like, does that saturate everything to do with equality? So we hit the variable DAG, which is the nested Markov model. And I think so at some point early there, I started asking, well, there are some known results on that question for Bell scenario, for certain scenarios that are simple. And so and then there was this question, well, how was that actually proven? Because I wanted to think about the general case. And I think a lot of the discussion was about that. And I think one of the things I kind of was hoping we would get to, and I don't think we did because there were a lot of subtleties discussing simple cases, is what it would take to... So the nested model is complicated, right? It has a complicated factorization, it's recursive, there are all these weird things going on. And so one would need to figure out what it would take, like what little pieces of the nested factorization you would need to build these examples for, to show that it indeed saturates. And so I don't think we quite got to that, but I sort of see, like, I got a better sense of what it would take, basically.
Yep.
So that's what I got out of that discussion. And I think I'd like to encourage folks who were there in the room to sort of chime in the special case discussion that happened as well.
Yeah, does anyone want to speak to the special case?
Yes, so but it's a proof we have, actually we shared it with you, Eddie. It's a proof we have with Victor. So in the triangle structure, you can do anything. There is a way to prove that you can do anything. And the way you do that is you first prove that you can do the shared random bit. And the way you prove you can do the shared random bit is just with a heuristic in which you just subtract two distributions. So you can, so in the triangle, it's clear that with a standard probabilistic model, you can do the distribution in which all party output at random. This is clear. And it's also clear that you can do the second distribution in which they never all output the same output. So they never output all zero, they never output all one, but the six remaining outputs are equally weighted. So the strategy is just, you have random variables which are zero or one, or sorry, random number between zero and one, and you compare them, are they bigger or smaller? And with this, you have this distribution, right? So you can obtain these two distributions. And then the idea is that if now you allow for negative probabilities, you can try to subtract these two distributions. It's a bit more complicated, but it's something like this. Just by subtracting, you obtain the shared random bit. And then if you have the shared random bit, you can reproduce any probability distribution. And I guess this heuristic can... Yeah, well, okay. I see it as a proof that these, quasi-probabilistic model are quite bad because you don't want to allow the shared probability in the triangle. But this is the way I interpreted it. I guess you can leverage this to, if you understand a bit more what's going on, you can really try to prove it.
And you will realize that Marco's argument was very subtle and ingenious. And so I hoped that based on abstract nonsense, you could just show that
yes,
everything that you, you know, if you allow for probabilistic models, you get just, you know, affinely closed observable distributions. And then Matthew convinced me that I was completely mistaken. But the next day, he came back and said that I convinced him that it might be possible, and then we didn't work it out. No? What do you think? No, with one more day. Did you oscillate back to impossible, or do you think it's?
I think it's still possible that it's just a simple abstract reason why it's true.
So there's an open problem whether one needs to be smart or whether one can be dumb and still do the
same. I think it's the same approach. What I do is just a concrete case, right? So
yeah.
I just say I want to subtract, so it's really going into one direction of the linear space, right?
So I guess my question is, if you wanted to do all bidirected, so all bidirected graphs is a nice special case, right, of the nested
yes,
model.
Yes, so this works. I think if you
say
before,
I'm just going to interrupt before we devolve into this conversation.
Sorry.
It sounds like there's lots to go into on this topic, and it sounds like it's ongoing, which is wonderful. So let's...
so the breakout room is open now.
So we're going to hold on to that thought and come back to it, is what I'm getting to. Right now, let's just review what was kind of discussed. It sounds like the underway. Is there anyone?
Wow. Sorry, can I just share another thought related to the quasi-probability?
Sure, yeah.
But it's not, yeah, sorry. It's just something that I discussed afterwards with Matt and Medium. I just asked Matt if this idea of putting a negative probability, but then restricting to the ones that correspond to Wigner functions, would give you some way to talk about like conditionals of quantum systems. And then Matt said that this was already done by John Barrett, and then there is some issue. Right.
So it sounds like it's still ongoing conversation. Lots of people have worked on it. It's great. Thank you. So we're going to move on to the next topic, just so we can get through all of them. I think we're on to restricted cardinality.
This was one of the breakout rooms that I kept coming back and thinking about afterwards. We began not by sort of sharing a bunch of known results, like here's what we know in this paper or the other. We just said, I think I walked in the room and Rob said, could inflation be used with restricted cardinality? To which I said, no, but I guess then he had an idea that maybe, and then we proceeded to talk about the answer was yes the whole time. But it sort of was really, I think, insightful. So we pointed out that I had no appreciation for this, but I convinced myself of it while we were talking, that if we wanted to discover polynomial equalities implied by a causal model, and these could be polynomial equalities implied by, let's say, causal models with unrestricted cardinality, or polynomial equalities that hold where there is a restriction on the cardinality. In principle, there's a way to do this where you can discover polynomials up to a certain degree, let's say degree 3 polynomials, by just taking 3 copies of your scenario and just randomly generating distributions which are compatible with the causal scenarios. You would create these causal models, and then you just define it as like a space of degree 3 monomials. And you do this again and again and again until like the dimension doesn't change and it's this following thing. And then there's this translation from monomials on the space of 3 copies from events on the space of 3 copies to monomials on the original probabilities. And so basically we find that you can discover linear constraints on the space of monomials, which of course just polynomials. And this could then be mixed with inflation, but I totally didn't appreciate that. And we also pointed out that we had tools which were sort of well-developed for dealing with entropies and restricted entropies, and a restricted cardinality implies a restricted entropy. So we could always take a shortcut and say, let's just convert this cardinality restriction into an entropic restriction and see what happens. I think we came up with like 4 different generic algorithms with different pros and cons for how to deal with these things, none of which have ever been used as far as I'm aware. But it was really nice to sort of just shoot the breeze and say, yeah, it could be done this way, it could be done that way.
So it sounds like a ton of progress.
Yeah, now it all needs to be done.
Done, yeah, of course. Isn't that the trick? Great, so anyone want to add anything to that?
that's good because that's the title of the workshop, right? Technically. I mean, we kind of forget, but that there was a strict cardinality in the title.
Yes.
So, you know, I have to say it really didn't go in the direction that I thought it was going to be. I was, I guess, I don't know why, thinking more that we were going to try to derive analytical results, like say, here is a technique for deriving an inequality in the presence of a restricted cardinality. But all the things that we talked about were really more about just testing whether or not a distribution could be achieved with restricted cardinality. It wasn't sort of like a nice, clean way of deriving inequalities per se.
Let's hold that thought and come back to it.
Yeah.
I think there's a good spot to talk about this a bit later. So can we go on to model selection?
So yeah, so I love that session because it shook me out of my nap, basically. So what I mean by that is, in statistics, we do a lot of model selection, right? But we do a lot on a very specific kind of model selection and very specific models that are nice. That have smooth parameter maps, BAC works on them, all sorts of nice things happen for them. And, we assume things like faithfulness if we do it a certain way. And the point is, like, the only reason we do all of those things is because we think about very nice model classes. And then, you know, Rob came along and said, look, man, like, we care about lots of crazy things that aren't like that, that are describable in weird ways. And it's not clear why the way to think about it is the right way to think about it. And, you know, it's true, right? And I think, like, what I got out of that, I mean, there was a lot of discussion that I hope other folks will pipe in to describe in more detail. But one thing basically that I came away with is we need to think about annoying models more in model selection. And I have to say, like, for me, that came up independently before. So, like, one great example of a terrible model is a union model. Like, a standard example is I want to do post-selection. So I want to first learn the graph and then do a causal effect after that. So there are some papers on this. But let's say I don't want to do that. I don't want to select. I just want to say I'm not sure which of these two graphs it is. So my model is a union. And then I want to do statistical procedures on a model like that. And that's a horrible model. It has discontinuities and stuff. It's just something that we, like, I think in causal inference and I think in quantum questions, I think that these kinds of things just come up all the time. And I think we need to spend a lot more effort in that than we have in the past. So I think the vast majority of model selection literature and statistics doesn't deal with cases like that. And I think maybe that has to change. That's what I got out of it.
So you took it as a challenge, basically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As I said, I was shaken out of my nap, basically.
That's wonderful. Does anyone else want to comment?
Hey, I guess for my part, I really came away with a better understanding of, like, the parameters that you're counting in the Bayesian information criteria. I don't think I understood that well at all. And so at the end of that session, I had a much better understanding of why the BIC makes sense and what kinds of, you know, models it makes sense to apply to. So,
yeah,
I think, like, for me, a lot of those information criteria were kind of black boxes and I didn't know how to think about them. So it was very clarifying.
Yeah, and also I think there was a great distinction made between, counting observed data and counting the causal model. So they're not the same and they're both interesting to think about. I think, like, a lot of Rob's questions were very penetrating that were about getting at that distinction, basically. And also notions of simplicity, I think, is great to think about because, you know, you can think of something simple as something like a small set, or you can think of something simple as a simple surface that describes the set. They're not the same. And yeah, anyways.
About clarifying language.
And maybe just add, I mean, that what we didn't resolve, but the question we sort of were pushing towards was there seems to be perhaps some tension between Occam's razor, the notion that you should prefer the simplest model, and, you know, Popper's notion of falsifiability, that you should prefer the model that explains less. So we were sort of looking at examples where it seemed like those two, you couldn't have both those things simultaneously. I'm not saying there is really a conflict there, I'm just saying that, yeah, I think it's an interesting question and we didn't agree to what the solution to that was.
Yeah.
Something for ongoing explorations. Does anyone else have anything they want to add to that room? Then we'll move on to polynomial optimization.
This was an interesting one, in that we sort of reached consensus and agreement pretty quickly, but still came away with what I thought is an idea which has maybe a lot of potential. So I think on day one, when we were initially suggesting the breakout sessions, David Gross said, SDBs! And I thought it was a joke. At first I was like, oh, he's talking about his SDPs, which was all these like, you know, convergent hierarchies for describing quantum causal models, and this being a workshop which is designed to sort of focus on topics, which we really think by bringing both communities together, that's where we want to make progress. And the breakout sessions were, you know, selected as topics where we really expected people should contribute and benefit from both. I was like, SDPs, SDPs is entirely a quantum problem. There's no way that's going to be a breakout session. And then the entire polynomial optimization was like, where have SDPs been all of our life in terms of classical causal modeling? They're like the solution to all of our problems, and we haven't realized this. Because, you know, Rob pointed out in his first day tutorial that when we have these hidden variables, we can always assign them cardinality, and then we can define causal compatibility in terms of quantifiers with these polynomial constraints. Polynomial constraints involving quantifiers. And it's then basically, oh, well, that's a really hard problem. We're stuck. So now we need to sort of find like shortcuts to get around that. And so we invent inflation, we invent entropic techniques, we invent all these things, because we all know that polynomial constraints involving quantifiers, you can't solve it. And then we realized, but actually you can. Or like you can approximate it really in a robust sense. You can get inequalities in the relaxation, like the Lasserre hierarchy and SDPs. We're designed for exactly this. So I think Pedro pointed out that there has been some work by one of Lasserre's students on the projection of semi-algebraic sets, which is exactly what we're talking about in terms of defining these marginal models. But I have never seen any paper in causal inference, not by any physicists nor by any statistician, where they said, here's the system of polynomial constraints. We went and we ran an SDP, and that's how we know that, you know, this is true, or we discovered an inequality by means of this. I don't mean like the covariance stuff that Matthias Dorton is doing. I'm talking about like actually in terms of the probabilities, not covariances. Mm-hmm. But it's completely doable. And I'm kind of wondering why has nobody done this? Like somebody should do this. And I think we're gonna try to find somebody to do that.
What I think is lovely there, just in contrast to the model selection, is there you get into this room, great agreement. That's where the progress comes from. The other place.
I think
we're totally different places, and that's the challenge. And in both ways, it's helpful. I just think that's an interesting contrast, back to back.
I don't know that. I think model selection room agreed for on a lot of it, right? It's just a lot of open stuff, basically.
But it did take some getting a lot more translation, I think.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
Question for Ellie. You had a caveat about if we're talking about the joint distributions, not covariance matrices. Is that because people have applied STP programs to covariance matrices?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So, but so what I'm saying, the caveat was
the
I was saying, I have not seen STPs used to derive inequalities.
Right.
So I've seen STPs used to derive inequalities on covariances. I just haven't seen STPs used to derive inequalities on probabilities. But there's no reason I can think of why it shouldn't be possible. It's probably because it's going to be computationally impossible, David has.
But I think, so if you look at these Lasserre methods for optimizing over classical sets, classical polynomial constraints, no? Then they are phrased in terms of all these moments where both covariances are the lowest level. And so I think what Lasserre does is he would take a statement about probabilities and convert it to a hierarchy of statements about modes. Of course, you can go beyond covariances, and then higher order cumulants, I guess, would happen. But I think that's how it looks like. So if people would run these, let's say, hierarchies to get you something on, so it would feel like they would be making statements about higher time moments. So I think it's not as incompatible as you're saying. Right?
So I think of the original NPA hierarchy and how it can be phrased in terms of expectation values, or how it can be done sort of in the Collins-Jossin basis, where you refer to joint probabilities and marginal probabilities. And I don't think that that's equivalent to moments, whereas the expectation values is closer to that. And I think that if we encode the letters, that they're not moments, that they represent marginal probabilities and joint probabilities and polynomials of probabilities in the generating set, then we should be able to derive constraints not on moments, but on the probabilities themselves. I don't see any reason why you could not.
Sounds like
right. Right. I see. All right. Okay. I think what's happening is actually that that they will end up putting a distribution on the space of distributions. Right. Because they are Okay, maybe I should stop at this point.
Yeah, that's,
I think
it sounds like some great ideas, and we can.
I think I understand how this works fits together, but maybe not in the way I can, you know, do it independently.
That's okay. Is there anyone else who wants to add to something that they think would summarize that discussion? Anything online? No. Okay. We're going to keep moving. So, Marc-Olivier, can you talk to the distributed computing conversation this morning?
Yes, so there is this independent community focusing on distributed computing problems, more specifically synchronous distributed computing in the local model. So it just means that, so basically you have nodes in a graph. These nodes have follow some procedure, computing procedure, in which they will first create some system, then share it with their neighbors, receive some system from the neighbors, apply some transformation, do it again. So each time you have these communication steps and you have T communication steps. And the question is what problems these processes can solve collaboratively. So typically what this processor want to do is to output a caller in the end of the procedure. So they have 2-3 communication steps, they will output a caller at the end. And the callers outputted by the processors should be such that it's a proper coloring of the graph. So 2 neighboring nodes should not output the same caller. And so the question they ask is, so usually with a classical strategy, with, for instance, N nodes placed in a loop, how many steps of communication I need to succeed at this task. And then you can ask the question, okay, now if I have a quantum strategy, can I do better? Actually, this is, so it's, okay, proposing a strategy is not so hard, but showing bound on what you can do with a quantum strategy is obviously quite hard, because it can be arbitrary dimension, etc. So what these people do is they go to some causal constraint, no signaling constraints, which are actually exactly what we would do with inflation. And okay, so they have interesting examples. And okay, actually, so what we have is we have these quantum inflation tools, which they don't have. So they are completely not able to find any constraint, which is just attached to the quantum formalism. They can't find causal constraint, and they derive that. But they are completely, like, they are lacking any quantum inflation like strategy to improve bounds, and we could hope to find something which is relevant for them.
Just a question of clarification. This is just a straight up computational complexity question, what they're working on, right?
It is a type of computational complexity question. So now,
So
each node has infinite computation power. So it's not about this. It's about the number of communication steps you need.
Yeah, no, there are formulas like that. Okay, I understand. Yeah,
so
I understand.
It's in number of steps of communication.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing computer science theory work on, basically.
Yeah.
Is there anything anyone else wants to add from the discussion to complete that discussion? Yes.
So one of the most interesting things that came out of it was a bit of a tangent, to some extent, to the main thing, which is Marc-Olivier was summarizing these kind of two perspectives, one of which is to sort of characterize all the distributions that you can get with non-fan-out inflations, which you were calling OPT approach. So it's sort of kind of a characterization of a set of distributions from this sort of hierarchy. And then the other would be like a more intrinsic characterization in terms of I have a theory that's governed, or maybe the set of theories for any generalized probabilistic theory, and like what can I get in the triangle scenario for them? And it's not obvious that these two things coincide. So first off, I was like, oh, that's an interesting question, whether it might be the case that we could find a hierarchy of non-fan-out inflations that exactly coincide with what you could get in any generalized probabilistic theory. But we also discussed a little bit about how these are two very different perspectives on that set of distributions, sort of like the top-down versus the bottom-up approach. Like, do you have some theory in mind that you're sort of trying to characterize the distributions of, or do you have instead, I don't know, you think of it as a kind of relaxation of...
I call it a dictionary. So the OPT approach would just be to say you can play with some devices, you can connect them in different ways. There are rules about how you can connect these devices. You can replicate these devices. And then you just ask the question, okay, do I have a concrete answer about what I will obtain for any way to connect these devices? And this is typically the inflation approach. You want a concrete probability distribution for each circuit you can build, such that the class of all these probability distribution is compatible one with each other. So you want a dictionary which maps any potential circuit to the corresponding probability distribution. So this is the most stupid theory you can imagine. There is no, it's not predictive, right? It's just you read what happens if your system is like this, this will happen. And if it's different, this will happen. And there is no explanation, no computation to do, right? You just read this. And the other approach is you have a theory and you compute, you have this description for this object, this matrix, this density matrix for that object, and you compute. And then the question is, it looks like a dual way to look at a theory, right? The one where you say, what is your GPT, your mathematical objects, your mathematical formalism, and the other one is just, okay, I just have this dictionary. And the question is, can you really find the correspondence for each OPT you do have a complete GPT? So it's a question we tried with Ellie to answer with Victor, and we thought we had the answer and it was wrong. And I have no idea how difficult it is, actually.
Thank you. Are there any questions online? No? Okay. So we're going to keep moving on. So the last one I think we've got here is from this morning. I think, you were both in the room. I think Ellie might want to take that one, but leave it open to both of you.
This last breakout session where we're trying to understand under what circumstances perfect correlation between a subset of variables can be achieved with conditioning was strikingly different, and to my mind, than the other ones. Because the other ones, we sort of said, we learned, oh, here are some references to go look. Like I was completely ignorant of tons of literature that Stefan has and others on characterizing constraints under post-selection. And now when I encounter those problems, my arsenal of literature that I can draw upon is much larger, and that's a great thing. And for the other breakout sessions, we had like, here are problems. If we encounter them, we have some like really good ideas how we're going to attack this. Like, this is an inflation for restricted cardinality, or this is how we're going to do STPs to relax, Penalian optimization. But this was a much more concrete problem. And we weren't saying, like, we're going to come up with a technique to solve it, or here's some literature about it. In fact, it's not a problem that I've never ever seen posed. Right? So like when I said, like, hey, there's this problem that I'm thinking about, it came up in a conversation that I was having with Marina and Matt Fusey and his PhD student. And then so many people raised their hand as if they were interested in this problem. And then Stefan stayed and Ilya stayed and you know, Rob and Evans tuned in to like have this conversation where I thought it was gonna be like the four of us off in some closet. It was like an honor that like, oh, people are actually interested in this. And then we made, I felt like, rapid progress. Like, I thought I understood it, and I was wrong on, you know, multiple counts, and Matt Jones made many corrections, Matt Pusey made many corrections, but like, this was one of these situations where, because we were all in one place, we got somewhere, and we got there really fast. It kind of reminded me of like the transition from when I was working at home to coming back to here at all, where like, I thought I was making progress at a decent pace at home, and then I was like, oh no, I was wrong. Like, when you talk to two or three people, it's like a completely different order of magnitude. And then, like, I was talking to like two or three people, and we had like, the 10 of us in the room working on the problem, I felt like we did in an hour what would have taken, you know, 2 months. And it's one of these situations where I feel like that was real progress made here at the workshop, where we didn't know something and now we've worked it out, and I feel like we could easily have, you know, halfway towards a publication. We're really very satisfied with how that went.
So, like, one really brief thing I'll mention. So it's not like a literature, but like a family of constructions people do. So, you know, like deseparation is complete. So the way you show that deseparation is complete is when things are deconnected, you have to find the guy that witnesses it, right, in your model. And so people do these constructions. I'm going to have a path. The path is going to have a bunch of colliders in it. I'm going to have to set some numbers there. And there was a similar, much more complicated construction that Stefan's former student did for chain graphs, right, Friedenberg, where because of how chain graphs are, it's not a path anymore, it's this more complicated thing, like a track or something. And I had a similar construction for proving conditional causal effects are complete, where again, you have a path. So it's not like there is a literature specifically on this problem, but there is a literature on constructions that make things dependent, maybe strongly dependent, basically with colliders. So there's definitely something to read. It's just one has to dig around a little bit.
Yeah, so I feel like this was exactly what I was hoping to get out of the workshop. It's both progress and sort of really useful references that I was not aware of. Like, Stefan, you pointed out this capital D separation, which I mentioned at the time, I would never have been able to Google. So, like, thank you for sending me a link.
That was a pre-Google concept, though.
I actually Googled it and got the wrong things. Because,
right.
Because there are lots of literature now who is not case specific in their so de-separation in much of the literature now actually is just a standard little de-separation.
Right.
But
it is in
Colin Friedman's book.
100% relevant. So that was a really satisfying experience.
That's wonderful. So I'm gonna put a pin up. So is there anyone else who wants to add to the discussion from that room this morning? Okay. On that, I think it's actually a really good point to pivot sort of to the next section that we want to talk about here. And this came out of some conversations I've had with people over the last few days, sort of about what they've learned, which sounds very general. But I mean it in sort of the specific sense of, in a way that wouldn't have been possible were you alone in your room trying to work this out. Or particularly if you were more isolated in the communities that we're used to being in. And so I think I wanted to pose the question to both of you. What have you learned broadly from the statistics side, and what have you learned from the physics side?
I've learned that I need to think about model representations better, and learn from physicists about how to think about really annoying, from statistical point of view, models, basically, for the purposes of doing inference and doing model selection problems, both. Because I think, my own career trajectory was such that I had a preference for nice models, right? So the nested model is a nice model. That's part of its point, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, so when I was saying that I was taking a nap, that's kind of what I mean, right?
Yeah.
I think, you can't do that forever, right? Eventually, models just get not nice. I think the big thing that I got, the big conceptual shift that I got from this workshop is that I need to really start thinking about annoying models more, basically. Like, they're just very important.
Will that impact your work in, say, classical?
Oh, yeah.
Could I add to that, that the set of models given by a DAG is one of these very nasty things?
Yeah, if you start doing things to the DAG, it's not.
Unless you have the ordering, in which case it's a nice manifold thing. Otherwise, it is one of these ridiculous things.
Yeah, DAGs are bad news, man.
Yeah. Stay away from it.
Yeah.
So, going in, we had a suspicion that we've had enough crossover and citations from the different communities to each other that probably there's a bunch of literature out there in statistics that I don't know that I don't know, or that we don't know that we don't know, and would be really useful if we could get people to tell it to us. But also, even to ask the right people, you have to sort of get on the same page. And we thought maybe we probably have some results that we've worked out in the physics community that are relevant. And it was a guess, because we don't know what we don't know. And we guessed clearly right. There's this now queue of multiple articles that I need to read that I never would have read if it wouldn't have come up in these conversations. They're like, oh, that's what you mean. Yes, this is the problem that we're talking about, but you call it that. So now I could read about models under selection. I can read about mags. That's a really useful concept. We have capital D separation. It's that's exactly what I was looking for, but I never would have known. So I've learned a lot of small things from the presentations, but more than that, I've collected an understanding of where I need to look for concepts that I'm working on, so I don't have to reinvent the wheel all over again.
And will that impact your work in physics then?
100%.
In what way?
When we're trying to sort of pose these questions, many of the questions that we've been talking about, it turns out, have been posed 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago by other people and worked out. So instead of trying to spend a month figuring out, can these things be distinguished, or how would we say anything about this, we can say, okay, we don't have to spend that time. This is a chapter in this textbook. It tells us how to do it. And then if we want to go beyond that, because I'm out of an example, at least we now have tools to draw from. We can see, this is how they did it. How would we do it? I think it's hugely valuable to see that problems that we didn't know other people were working on have been worked on.
What about everyone else? I know there's some people who've mentioned things to me, so anyone?
Yeah, I have a very specific example where I think Ellie saved us about 2 weeks of work trying to figure out whether our construction works on larger line scenarios, where the answer was no. we probably it would have taken some time before we spot that.
Yeah.
I have a few comments that just about epistemology, I guess. I remember being a grad student, and one of the biggest challenges is every paper I read, I just didn't know how to make the information stick because they didn't have a network to embed it in. One of the things that's great about sort of learning a field is that you get a new piece of information and you immediately know where to slot it in and how to recall it because it fits in now. And so like when you're moving into a new field, you kind of first need to build up a sort of web of knowledge so that the new information sticks. And so I taught a causal inference course just recently, and I was trying to kind of organize all this stuff. And I managed, but there were still like big gaps in my ability to organize. And I feel like getting together in person and kind of thermalizing and having conversations, like it's just so much more effective than reading papers at getting kind of the subtle clues as to how we think about these things. Like, oh yeah, slot it in this way. Oh yeah, that seems like a totally different word, but it's very close to everything that people think about over here. And so like that sort of soft problem of just how do you organize all this terminology and information and techniques into some sort of big organized picture. I think these kinds of meetings really help with that sort of thing. So I think I was really helped in terms of how I should organize certain concepts that I wasn't very familiar with before.
So you're sort of building up a new web, so to speak, and
yeah. I mean, I think I don't know about statisticians, but from a physics perspective, we always want grand unified theories. And so what I want is a kind of grand unified theory of causal inference, where sort of any given problem in causal inference, I kind of know where to slot it in and say, oh yeah, that's a problem of this type, and it's on the fringes of this kind of problem. But I basically kind of understand, you know, for every given problem, here are the various techniques you can use, and here's their complexity and pros and cons. Like if we had like an understanding of all of that, well, that's what I would like.
Anybody else want to add to that? Please.
So, the things I got up from this workshop are a lot simpler because I stumbled upon the subject, you know, out of pure luck. I just, you know, saw a talk of Rob's on Pearsa.org, and I was like, this is really cool. I want to learn about this, and this was a great opportunity for me to just see, you know, what everyone is doing. You just kind of kickstart my own research. And also, I was thinking about this model selection stuff and trying to put a computational spin on it. And I didn't really understand, you know, what these information criteria and et cetera came from, you know, the number of parameters thing. And I talked to, you know, Ilya and Stefan, and now I know even less. When Rob, you know, in that talk, model selection talk, Rob said basically what I was thinking, and I felt really validated in thinking. So it was also great for me. But yeah, I really appreciate this opportunity to, you know, talk to all these people.
That's wonderful. Anybody else want to add in? Anybody online?
Nobody online.
Anyone else?
Yeah, can I just one?
Please.
So when I presented my talk, I was trying to explain an idea like some there's this thing that is like steering, but then when you think about it, classically it's like vision updating, and I was like confusedly trying to explain it. And then afterwards, Murat came to me and then he was like, "Are you talking about moralization?" And I was like, "I don't know, what is that?" And then he was like, "We speak different languages." And then I think, yes, that's exactly what I was talking about, but I didn't know.
It's a really nice concrete example. I like that. It's wonderful.
I should add, my universe has exploded in this world. I think that has been wonderful because, I mean, I have been working with graphical models for some time,
mm-hmm.
and I have been sort of hearsay and had a few examples of, and I knew there was these issues about quantum and Bell's inequality stuff. And I've known that there was something on that since a long time ago. But I have no idea that to the amount of detail and the amount of sophistication and the amount of, and that has been great for me to experience. And there are lots of words now that I have heard that I've not heard before. Some of them I might even think I know what they mean now. But there's still a long way to go. But there's just no way that sort of expansion of knowledge can happen just by sitting and reading or anything like that. Or participating online either. So I'm actually very happy. I've been here, so thank you very much.
Anyone else? So in the spirit of that, I'm going to just kind of twist that question a little bit for each of you and say, what would you want to tell people from, what would you want people from the other field to take away from this? So what do you want statisticians to take away from this conference, from physics?
That's a hard question. I think I enjoyed almost all the talks. But I wonder.
Wow.
You know who you are. I wonder whether that's true for the statisticians, because a lot of them were sort of quantum heavy, and I you know enjoyed it very much. But I wonder, did we do enough in the beginning to sort of communicate the value of some of these physics concepts and these problems which we're working on in quantum physics as having a classical application to it? I don't know whether we communicated that 100% effectively, but I think that we have ways of thinking about problems. We have problems that are important to us. And just to sort of maybe convey that, I think, Stefan, you were saying it's sometimes about not just lexicon, but also prioritization.
Mm-hmm.
That when you sort of are coming across these problems, which actually are of relevance to quantum physicists, that should sort of trigger, right, this is the sort of thing where I would expect physicists to have something to say about.
I mean, as a statistician and a statistician, and I can't say I understood every detail of every quantum talk, but I think I found it valuable anyways, just because, as Rob says, you have to get the vibe of the community and the way, like, the ontology that they use, how they think about things. And so I think that the more, I mean, this is not the first, I mean, there was this Berkeley workshop, right, in the spring that I also attended. So, like, the more I go to these, the more I get a feel for the problems that matter in the physics end of this, right, which I think, so I think that was very valuable. The one thing that I think it might be useful to pay attention to in the physics end. So in statistics, we kind of have two views on inference problems. We have the distribution view and the finite sample view, right? So there are samples that come from a distribution, and they interrelate in complicated ways. And if you're a frequentist, you're interested in what happens as the number of samples goes to infinity. And as a Bayesian, maybe you don't do that. You just look at what you have in front of you and you get your posterior. And the sense that I got from watching these talks is, the physics view for these kinds of problems is very distribution. It's kind of a distribution view.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm very sympathetic to that because I came from that world. So Perl, like, when he thinks about identification theory, it's very distribution-like, right? There is I identify given infinitely many samples, right? So I'm very, like, sympathetic to that view. But I have to say, I graduated and I went to Harvard and I learned about finite samples. And I think that really opened my mind to a lot of things that I didn't think about before. And so I'm guessing what ends up happening is people who do theory in physics, they talk to experimentalists, and then experimentalists end up worrying about finite samples and the actual experimental setup. And what I'm saying is, like, my experience on the way my career trajectory went, like, I found it very valuable to get exposed more to the other side because it allowed me to think things that I couldn't think before, just thinking about distributions all day long. So,
I think mostly in physics, we can produce data in basically unlimited quantities. It's not always true, but it's mostly true, so it's much less of a problem. So, like in a clinical trial, every patient enrolled is $100,000 and an ethical form you have to fill out. Here, it's running the computer that runs the experiment for 1 hour more, and you have 100,000 more samples. It's not always the case, though, Peter. Of course, talked a lot about the p-value problems with the first loophole-free Bell experiments. But this was actually one of the first contact points of many of us with p-values, for example, because for the first time we had to care, because normally we are just operating in the asymptotic regime where nobody cares. So I think it's less, I hear what you say, but I think it's just less relevant for many of the physics experiments that can produce an enormous amount of data.
I guess what I'm trying to say, I get what you mean. And I think there are settings like in statistics that are like this, like reinforcement learning, Alpha Zero can play as many chess games with itself as it wants, right? So it's kind of like that. But what I'm saying is, like, it's just about the ontology and the point of view. I think like there are some things that are hard to think about without adopting the point of view of here are my samples and I want to think about the samples that I have. And so there are a lot of stuff in causal inference, quite old, some of it that was derived in that view, basically. Anyways.
Yeah, I think you're right that certainly, in the Bell community, certain people do work with experimentalists on, you know, proving that there's non-classicality in some setup. And you know, you think about things differently after you've had to go through that. It's, you know, very different from just doing research about what are the in principle predictions of quantum theory for infinite run situations. You know, it's, you never encounter the question of how would I test this and become confident that I've ruled out classical worldview.
I should say that, I mean, it's true physicists can produce these experiments, but sometimes they're actually quite expensive. I think CERN is a very expensive endeavor. For example, and I also think there is physics is also a huge subject, right? There's many things that we've talked about quantum physics. This is my first interaction with quantum physicists, but I've been talking to astrophysicists and they don't do many experiments in astrophysics.
So that's why, I mean, many universities, like traditionally it was physics and astronomy, they were two different subjects,
yes,
defined by exactly that distinction, and then they can't, like, repeat the Big Bang 100,000 times with an FU script.
And somehow, somehow you think they might not be the same subject. And the but I've been to cross-disciplinary workshops with astro and particle physics, which is, this is quite a challenge. You think this is a challenge?
Yeah.
Particle physicists and astrophysicists
in the same room. Okay. Absolutely, yeah. So we're going to take a quick pause on that conversation here.
Yes, we're going to just sign that. So Stephanie, if you would join us here.
We've all been in communication with Stephanie Mo, but maybe you haven't said hello face to face. I think you're greeting people on day one. This goes back months, with many, many, many hours, many, many, many emails, far more from Stephanie to everyone here than from us to Stephanie, but we certainly have heard many, many times. The idea, let's say, of using Slack to communicate and to make sort of the hyperlink better, that was Stephanie's idea. So she's manages all of our conferences, all of our shops that are hosted at Perimeter. We are tremendously lucky to be able to benefit from her past experience and from her expertise in putting this together. I have absolutely no complaints. I think this went as smooth as it could. So, big round of applause to Stephanie.